Good morning and welcome to Rich Answers, a public affairs program brought to you by Light 100.5 WRCH and the Conference of Churches. I'm Reverend Dr. Shelley Best, and I'd like to welcome you to an hour of conversation and inspiration with transformational leaders in and about Greater Hartford. Today, we are fortunate to have with us Dr. Miriam Jernigan Noesi, who is the president and CEO of Jernigan and Associates, a psychological and educational consulting firm that provides professional development services for educators, mental health providers, and healthcare organizations. Dr. Jernigan Noesi has over 15 years of experience as a licensed professional psychologist specializing in the treatment of children, adolescents, couples, and families. She recently co-authored an article for the Institution for the Study and Promotion of Race and Culture entitled Hashtag Racial Trauma is Real, and that is stirring up national buzz and conversation. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
We're glad that we have you here. So give us a little bit of background. Where did you grow up?
I actually grew up in Western Mass in Springfield, Massachusetts.
And what was it like for you to be there?
Very fond memories growing up in Springfield, Mass. So I have three siblings and grew up in a household with a father who is a Vietnam veteran who really introduced me to the field of mental health, just sort of watching his engagement with veterans at the Vet Center in Massachusetts, and he also served at the state level as the Commissioner for Veteran Services under the Dukakis administration.
And that's powerful. So your father served in what military branch?
He was in the Army. He was drafted into the Army at a very young age, so sort of post around 18, 19 years of age, and did a few tours of duty in Vietnam, which, you know, interestingly enough, as a younger person, I think he shared less. As he continues to age, I hear more and more about his story, so it sort of allows me to go back and have more of a context and framework for what I saw kind of growing up in terms of the importance of the work. So he worked with veterans, but he was also a staunch advocate of veterans of color and the issues in particular for Black veterans in terms of receiving services and culturally competent mental health services in particular.
So do you remember your father being deployed?
I do not. So I was not yet born. It was when my father actually returned from Vietnam that he met my mother, who's originally from Florida. She had moved to Springfield with relatives, and they met. I'm the youngest of four, so I was the last coming into the family.
The baby of the family.
The baby of the family, absolutely.
And so when you think about your experience growing up in a home with a father who was a soldier mm-hmm. and the work that he was doing, what did you see? What did you observe as a child?
My parents are, you know, really taught all of their children to be really kind of aware. So there are sort of mantras that I hold near and dear to me now that I can remember my parents sort of saying when we were growing up, and, you know, really teaching us to be proud of who we were as children of color, really teaching us to have a connection to sort of our spirituality and our Christianity. But also, you know, my father would say things like, make sure that you sort of whatever information you're taking in, get it from multiple sources. So he taught me, and I remember being in high school and one of my teachers commenting on the fact that every morning on my bus ride into high school, I would get a newspaper. I saw my father do that. So I'd read the newspaper, and I remember my high school teacher commenting on that. For me, it was just sort of typical and normal. My father would watch the news, read the news, and encourage us to sort of get any information that we were taking in from multiple sources, but also to view it with a critical lens and to understand that every story has a context and everyone's, you know, sort of has, may have their own agenda. And so it's, you know, often helpful to just remain aware of that and to always think about things sort of beyond your own personal experience. So they were really big also on taking us outside of Massachusetts. So we grew up with humble beginnings, but my father would pile us into a van, you know, on Sundays and take us on drives and always say to us, you know, there are some people that never make it outside of their neighborhood. So to the best of our ability, we want to make sure that you all are able to see, you know, different areas and sort of appreciate different cultures as well.
So when you think about your upbringing, you came to knowledge of your path as a person of a certain era. When you think about mm-hmm. being first generation of some opportunities, what mm-hmm. was it that your parents planted in you so you would want to pursue higher education in the way that you did?
education, I think, was the really big piece. So I remember, you know, walking with my siblings always to the public library. My mother would bring us to the library. And really, for me, I love reading and books, but I think that was instilled by my parents. So they always talked about the importance of education. They always shared their personal experiences in terms of what they saw and the opportunities that were not available, and encouraged us to pursue opportunities, you know, by any means necessary is kind of one of the other mantras that I hold very near and dear to my heart. But education was a really, really, really big one in our household.
So it sounds like for you growing up, you grew up in a family where they were pushing you towards achieving yourself, but also pushing you towards service. How did you first get involved with reaching out and providing service in your community?
It, again, started with family. So I watched my parents either through church, you know, the church we attended in Springfield, Massachusetts, but they were very involved in the community. So they took us with them, you know, oftentimes in terms of, you know, engaging in volunteering, whether it was through the efforts my father was doing with his sort of veterans group, but also, again, with our church. So that was really just a part of our upbringing, giving back, understanding the importance of community, understanding the importance of building up the community, in an effort to continue to allow the community to grow. And I still see them do that. So they've since transitioned to my mother's birthplace in Crestview, Florida, and they continue to do things, you know, alongside their church in terms of, you know, whether they're breakfasts or sort of giving back to the senior citizens in the neighborhood, always trying to build youth development programs for youth, you know, to this day. So that was really a big part of our upbringing.
So think back of your high school years when you were thinking about going to college. What were you thinking about doing?
I knew. So part of my, you know, personal narrative and story, I talk about as a current mental health professional, is the fact that I knew pretty early on, and my parents would say the same thing, that I wanted to. I didn't have the language of what psychology is, but I knew that I wanted to help people. And there was something about watching, at that time, mostly older men that my father was working with in the vet center kind of go off into this sort of room and have discussions and come out, and that, you know, talking about the support that they felt, it was of interest to me. It was sort of later on in high school where I chose to sort of begin to have thoughts about working with children and adolescents in particular. So part of the questioning for myself was, you know, these were adults. I didn't understand war. I didn't understand things like post-traumatic stress, but I wondered, you know, if adults are having issues, doesn't it make sense? Is kind of the question I said to myself, to actually begin working with people at a younger age, because the issues that people often have in adulthood, if you could intervene earlier on, perhaps some of those issues won't be as significant. And so my focus has really been on children, adolescents, and obviously families as a result.
So you chose the path of psychology. Who were some of your early mentors that started to really introduce you to the profession?
First and foremost, as I said, my parents, but I attended Fisk University, which is a historically black college and university in Nashville, Tennessee. And the first mentor I can remember having, I actually attended at a time when the Department of Psychology was transitioning. So Dr. Raymond Winbush, who at that time was the head of the Race Relations Institute, had come into the department and had begun to sort of shift the curriculum for the Department of Psychology. And I really sort of remember him welcoming students into his office and saying to me, you need to go to graduate school, and this is how to do it. And really sort of providing the knowledge and education that, you know, I was, you know, figuring out for myself in many ways. So that was my first mentor. And I have been very fortunate for every institution that I've been a part of to have a person of color and psychologists who've kind of taken me under their wing and provided me with opportunities that have allowed me to get to the next level. So just to name a few more, Dr. Elaine Penderhughes at Vanderbilt University, and then more recently at Boston College, my mentor, who's actually the director of the Institute for the Study and Promotion of Race and Culture, who I still work with currently in a collaborative effort, Dr. Janet Helms, who's a really prominent figure in the field of psychology in general and has really talked about and written about race and race relations and culture in particular.
Along the way, when you were studying psychology in college, I'm sure that you had the experience of an awakening that some of the information that was in the field was not really favorable towards people of color. How did you relate to that understanding, and how did you pursue the field anyway?
That was a big part of my education, particularly at, you know, at Fisk University. I think my parents instilled and sort of planted the seeds early on, but it was really attending Fisk and having professors who said, you know, this is the traditional field of psychology and this is information you need to know. But they brought in sort of additional readings and curriculum and perspective and said, again, that message of looking at the field with a critical lens and saying, you know, these traditional approaches have been, you know, sort of researched in different communities. So the findings are relevant for different communities. How do we begin to sort of understand things that we're seeing in the community? So it was also at Fisk that I was able to go into the community with some of my professors to actually work in the Nashville area with some of the housing communities there and begin to kind of modify what we, you know, sort of saw as being important in the field of psychology, but to make it really more appropriate for communities of color, for lower income communities as well.
These days, a lot of people are doing work around reducing racial and ethnic health disparities in a variety of fields. Mm-hmm. How are people working today to reduce racial and ethnic health disparities in the field of psychology? And how have you seen that in your profession?
You know, I actually, my career, as I'm attempting to build it, is pretty varied. So I would include myself as a person who also is looking at racial and ethnic health disparities. And it was through my observations when I was actually a postdoctoral fellow at Children's Hospital Boston in the Department of Adolescent and Young Adult Medicine that I began to notice as the mental health provider working alongside primary health care physicians, as well as nursing professionals and nutritionists, we were attempting to look at the holistic health of adolescents, but I began to sort of notice disparities between and among those young people of color who were coming to see me. So, for example, I'm treating, you know, from a mental health perspective, young people with a variety of mental health issues, and I began to notice the co-occurrence of some of the physical health issues, including increased weight, for example. And the, I think, additional piece to that is what I noticed from a prevention as well as a medical intervention standpoint is that there were less resources available and less attention to addressing these particular, you know, issues. And so I think alongside my colleagues, we said we need to form a committee. We need to look more closely at the integration of things like behavioral health, mental health, and physical health outcomes. So that was really working in hospital settings in particular and in primary care settings where I kind of formalized my desire to begin to, you know, have a background in the clinical research related to the disparities literature. And that's actually what brought me to Connecticut. So I transitioned from Massachusetts and began an additional fellowship at Yale University in their School of Medicine, which was designed for, in particular, psychologists who were interested in engaging in research and developing interventions. So I took my background as a mental health professional, and the desire over the next 3 or 4 years for me was to work with Black adolescent girls who I know have been disproportionately affected by sort of increased weight and negative health outcomes in an attempt to develop these culturally competent interventions that address physical health outcomes, but really bring in into and integrate into the interventions issues around mental health that may inform, you know, what we're seeing as outcomes in terms of the disparities.
We're talking with Dr. Mariam Jernigan-Noesi, who is the president and CEO of Jernigan and Associates, and we'll be back after the break. You're listening to Rich Answers from the Conference of Churches on Light 100.5 WRCH. Be sure to like us on Facebook and tell us what inspires you. Welcome back. We're talking with Dr. Mariam Jernigan-Noesi, who is the president and CEO of Jernigan and Associates. In our last segment, we were talking about your background coming into the field of psychology. But then when you entered the field as a professional, I'm sure, like so many mental health professionals, you started to encounter a relationship between the Department of Children and Families or health service agencies with people of color. Talk about some of those early experiences, especially with young people in the mental health system who are also involved in the child abuse system.
Sure. Certainly, as a mental health professional sort of dedicated to working with children and adolescents, it's really important, it has been critically important in the various states that I've worked in to have a connection with organizations like the Department of Children and Family Services. I find that, and I've actually conducted some trainings that sort of speak to, when understanding issues that are important for children and families, also understanding the complexity that may inform what we often see sort of show up in the office or as outcomes. I think I've been really fortunate to have positive relationships, but also to be able to communicate with persons in those organizations to offer my perspective based on my experience as a direct service provider about how we sort of take into consideration some of the context, some of the factors that may contribute to some of the mental health issues, again, as well as related physical health issues that become important for children and adolescents, but also how we begin to integrate in their family systems as well becomes a pretty important point for us to take into consideration. So I have found that, through those relationships that we've been able to share ideas, or come to the table, and again, based on my background, offer some perspective around not just naming the importance of understanding context and culture in particular, but what that looks like from a prevention as well as an intervention standpoint. So direct service as well as looking at the various systems that children and families exist in to understand how we can potentially advocate and intervene for them.
Would you say that today you're still seeing a stigma within the African-American community in particular about seeking mental health services?
Yes, and I think my colleagues would share that view as well. Often what I try to do is provide, when I can, for persons who are able to take the step and to come in for therapy. I find myself providing a lot of what we call sort of psychoeducation, but really talking to people about what therapy is, what you can expect. And if I'm not offering that, as a direct service provider, I do try to go into the communities and offer that message as well. So I give people advice in terms of being able to maybe think about when it might be helpful to actually seek a professional, to assist you with some of the issues, because a lot of times there's this history of sort of secrecy and sort of keeping one's business in the home, so to speak, when in fact people are really struggling and suffering and could actually benefit from mental health services. So I think the more that we can continue in many ways to share the message that there are professionals, and this is how mental health professionals can help. Although we're seeing increasing numbers, of persons in the African American community in particular beginning to seek mental health services, but I think there's still, much greater need to continue to get that message out.
So these days, very often people are involved in mental health services because there's other systems that are involved. So let's say, for example, a child is struggling in school. Very often we see a high rate of children of color being provided with medication because automatically people are thinking it's attention deficit disorder and some other diagnosis. How do you help parents deal with the possibility of the school system saying, I want to put your child on medication, but maybe the child is just being who they are? How do you deal with this?
I this is an interesting point to talk about. One of my very dear childhood friends who I actually grew up with in Springfield, Massachusetts, and actually met as a family. So her father was also a Vietnam veteran. So our fathers were connected in that way as a child psychiatrist, a child and adolescent psychiatrist. We have this conversation often. And so what I try to tell people is that from the perspective of thinking about how we treat mental health, we really do approach it from a biological, psychological, and social perspective. So in fact, for some people, medications can be very helpful. What I would offer, and I think what Dr. Melena Banks, who's my colleague, would offer is it should not necessarily be the first point of intervention. So she's a very conservative psychiatrist. So I try to find colleagues that also, especially when working with children and adolescents who are much younger, to educate them. And I encourage parents to ask questions, to seek and make sure that you're exploring all alternatives. Medication by itself will not address an issue. It has to, it usually, in terms of our research, what we know is that it should be accompanied by mental health services, but also environmental interventions as well in the school system at home. So I have sort of red flags that go up if the first point of intervention for some people is medication, and there aren't other recommendations. So I would encourage parents in particular to be educated. So when someone is attempting to, you know, prescribe a medication, ask what it's for, ask what the side effects may be, ask if there are other alternatives, because unfortunately I do find that there are, for some people, that is sort of the first point of intervention without, you know, exploring other options or alternatives.
And sadly, we're living in a time where for so many young people, it is a school to prison pipeline, where the young people might have behavior issues, they're looking at a psychological response to that. Mm-hmm. But then in addition to it, if a child has certain behaviors, immediately the police are brought in, and there the young child of color is put on a particular track. How, as a psychologist, can you help a family deal with those kinds of issues?
I feel as though, and I think that there are other mental health professionals. I am also, I see myself as an advocate. As a child, adolescent, sort of family therapist for many years, I often work in collaboration with, in conjunction with school systems. I find, you know, that's my priority, and I feel that's my responsibility. So I can offer direct services, but one of the other aspects in terms of what I offer as a professional is, you know, if a school needs professional development, you know, whether they're sort of teachers, the counselors, the support staff, or the administration. That's actually how my consulting agency started, was by offering sort of information for school systems and for educators who are often more focused on educational outcomes. So by going in and also providing them with education, I think that's been a really critical piece in terms of helping educators understand what kids may be bringing into the classroom and what are ways in which they might address what they see as behavioral issues, because that's often the referral that I get. And in Massachusetts as well as Connecticut, where, you know, there's behavioral issues, there's sort of the red flag. And I always try to tell people that's the outcome. That's sort of the end piece. What is it that's led up to what it is that we're seeing that may be an issue or concern? And how can we address that? So it really is about shifting the questions that we're asking in an attempt to both prevent future issues, but also intervene, you know, in the immediate time period.
And you're speaking of something really powerful, that the behavior might be an outcome. And when you experience young people who are living, for example, in a city like Hartford, where we are in a city where there's a high rate of poverty. Many of the young people are living in neighborhoods where they have experienced vicarious trauma. There's violence that might be in their neighborhood or in their home. How does that reflect in the behaviors of the child when they're exposed to that in their environment? How does it affect their behaviors when they're in the school system or other places?
That's a really important consideration, again, for persons working in educational systems, is that if we take poverty as one example, you know, depending on sort of lack of financial resources, that can affect the very things that impact and influence the healthy development of children and adolescents. So thinking about things like food security, has a child had breakfast? Thinking about taking into consideration, you know, if there are issues of abuse, domestic violence, or even sort of community violence, and the impact that that has on a child viewing or witnessing those types of events, and then sort of waking up and entering into a, you know, a school setting where they're expected to sit and to focus and to learn. And so what I often, you know, talk about is the fact that it would be very difficult. I ask people to have, you know, kind of empathy and sort of put yourself in the, you know, in the shoes of a child. Remember your own childhood, if that helps. But what might it be like to not have food, you know, prior to coming into the school setting, or to witness violence in the community or in your household, or to have relatives, for example, who may have died or been killed, you know, for example, some of the, you know, based on some of the examples that I've seen. And then you're asking a child to kind of sit in an environment, to be still, you know, for example, and to take in information, you know, intellectually. It's difficult. They're going to be distracted. They may act out because they're still developing their emotional, what we call emotional intelligence, so their ability to express themselves. So it becomes really important for school systems to be aware of the needs of the students that they're serving in an effort to connect to community resources, but also, again, to not simply focus on what they're not seeing, but how you can perhaps engage the communities and provide resources for children as well as their families to address some of those other factors that may influence their ability to, you know, engage and achieve successfully or not, is the bottom line.
We're talking to Dr. Mariam Jernigan, who is the president and CEO of Jernigan and Associates, and we'll be back after the break.
30,000 square feet. What would you do with that kind of possibility? Would you strategize your future? Or get lost in the past? Will you fill it with stories? Or use it to empty your mind? Would you explore your spirituality? Or focus on improving your community? Will you use it to work late? Or just work it? Could you create lasting impressions? Or a brief, delicious one? Our vision for the 224? 30,000 square feet of endless possibilities.
Welcome back. In our last segment, we were talking a bit about what people might see in the behaviors or the interactions of young people who might be struggling with mental health issues based on context. When you look at your consulting practice, how can a psychologist work with some healthcare providers or educators to improve what happens in the classroom or in the community as a whole? How do you do that?
My initial entry into sort of working with agencies was in educational environments. And it was as a community-based mental health professional that I began to receive a lot of referrals for, at that particular time, more adolescents in secondary school settings for behavioral issues. And so for me, given where the referrals were coming from, it kind of allowed me to think more about, again, if this is an issue, and you know, the referrals were coming for a certain segment of the population, so mostly students of color, who were located in a particular high school setting, my first question to my colleagues at that particular time was, is there another way for us to understand this? So I actually, as opposed to, I certainly could have taken on each individual child, treated them individually, but as a person who's been sort of trained in advocacy and kind of multi-systems interventions, what we chose to do was to go into the high school and kind of set up a needs assessment. Let's talk to a larger group of students and sort of see what are their perspectives about what's going on. Let's also talk to and address the concerns of the school, the administration, the support staff, and the parents. And so what ended up happening at that particular time was, based on the feedback that we received, in fact, students were acting out due to their perceptions, in this case, of racial discrimination and unfair treatment with regard to disciplinary actions and just feeling really marginalized. These were students of color in a predominantly white school setting. And so that led to a kind of five-year endeavor, at least in the Massachusetts area. That's the basis of my work now, really focusing on providing support for students, but also allowing that direct surface to carry over and to engage in professional development for teachers to help them understand that these are, in fact, the experiences of students. What you may see show up may cause, you know, sort of reason for concern, but that's also contributing to these disparities that the school noted in terms of disciplinary action for students of color. So it really is about taking the time to take a step back and understand, you know, in educational environments, which then, again, sort of subsequently led to many schools have school-based health centers. There are places where students and children and adolescents are going to be. And so from a health equity perspective, they're opportune environments to be able to provide in-school and after-school resources for students. Health resources, you know, for example, which may, again, address the issue of in the adolescent clinic, by way of example, we often had a high no-show rate at Children's Hospital. And that was because, you know, adolescents had a difficult time making it to their appointments. If you are able to integrate and offer resources to students in the setting where they're expected to go, that really cut down on, you know, the issue of no-show rates. You can send a pass to a classroom, for example, have a student come down and see a nurse practitioner in particular or mental health professional to address and also follow up in ways that you can't if you're kind of isolated and separate from. So the big piece for me is sort of understanding what are the needs. And then where are the people that are sort of in need? Where do they live and exist? And how can we better go and service the community, children, adolescents, rather than expecting them to come to, you know, a particular office? So I try to locate myself, you know, in various places. So I do have a, you know, a private practice, but I also work again with, school-based health centers.
And so when we look at a community like Hartford, it's a community that has a lot of needs. And one of my particular concerns is when it comes to violence in the community, how we care for young people who are standing on the sideline. Maybe they aren't the one directly impacted, but we don't see grief teams that necessarily go to inner city schools. When it comes to the best of all possible worlds and the services that you could offer or a firm like yours, what could be offered to young people given the context of a place like Hartford when it comes to their mental health?
I think for school systems to, you know, take the time to become aware of what community resources, you know, may be available, so to pay attention and to sort of ask what are the needs of our students and how can we better connect to resources that perhaps, you know, the school system may not themselves be able to offer becomes a really important question. That includes identifying, you know, whether there are individuals that are in private practice or affiliated with hospitals. But the other, I think, piece, and I think movement in educational systems is really looking at how you can integrate from a prevention standpoint, sort of school-wide types of programming that would, again, allow you to address the needs of students. So, you know, on the one hand, you're attempting to prevent some of the outcomes that are of concern, but also connecting to be able to, for those students that are in crisis, for example, be able to connect families to resources that'll be most helpful.
And what are some of those school-wide activities that could come about?
So one of the projects that I'm currently working on and thinking about is actually sort of mirrors the project that I spoke about previously. So mental health in school system is becoming a topic, I think, in the Connecticut area as well as my affiliations in Massachusetts. And so one of the things that we're attempting to do is to highlight some of what we've talked about today, which is the issues of trauma. And we are attempting to, you know, for example, connect to universities, higher education, sort of colleges that may have trainees or persons who are in need of training but also have a skill set that they could offer. So in being creative, you know, for example, we are connecting to, in this particular case, Boston College, where the Institute in Study and Promotion of Race and Culture is, connecting to their master's level, you know, counseling psychology program, and we have what are referred to as mental health advocates. So these are students, master's level students who have skill sets, who are able to go into the school and assist the school because it's a part of their training. So it's training that they also need to provide the school with a service that's of benefit, you know, to the school. Also through that university, you know, partnership, we're able to offer skill sets in terms of program evaluation. So, you know, in thinking about what the advocates can go in and work directly with support staff, perhaps they can meet with students when, you know, counselors may be overwhelmed or social workers may be overwhelmed to offer systematic programming. It also allows us, because you have, you know, sort of professors and persons who are well-versed in program evaluation, who can evaluate the program and say, okay, this was, we've identified some needs, we've implemented a program, an intervention program. Is it in fact working? And so I think through university partnerships as a resource as well, you often kind of address the needs that sometimes schools have with, you know, sort of lack of financial resources to hire, you know, additional staff or additional persons to come in.
So when you look at your firm, where do you see your firm going in the course of the next few years? What are you working on developing?
I'm really excited more recently. I actually started Jernigan & Associates when I was still living in Massachusetts, and it was upon moving to Connecticut that, you know, I was led to kind of sort of transition the agency to be able to address, again, sort of issues that I see and pay attention to. So I have a number of associates that are in the field of psychology and education that I work with that are really dispersed nationally. So I really, you know, as a person who's living in Connecticut now, am very interested in, you know, sort of becoming more connected to the community here in the Hartford area. But also I think where we're going is really addressing some of the issues that we know to be important. So issues, you know, for us, a priority is sort of understanding disparities, understanding the importance of race and culture, from a needs-based perspective, as well as, you know, when we're offering services. And so we, you know, are really working at this point at a national level, based on needs at the K through 12 level, as well as in some cases, higher education. So colleges who may also, now, those disparities kind of carry over into higher education as well. So being able to identify and provide a variety of what we call technical assistance, which is, you know, offering specific recommendations around how to identify and then address and develop programming, but also doing a lot of professional development training. So again, working with educators, whether they're professors or teachers or administrators, to help them have a little bit of a different lens with respect to understanding some of the concerns like disparities in educational outcomes, retention, you know, at the higher education level, or dropout rates if we're talking about, you know, K through 12.
And so if people want to find out more about your firm, how do they find out more?
We are very active in terms of social media. Certainly there's a website available, and it is MM Jernigan Associates, J-E-R-N-I-G-A-N Associates.com. That really will give you the majority of the contact information in terms of email address. It also provides an overview of the services that we offer for healthcare as well as K through 12 organizations in higher education. There is also a link for myself in terms of accessing direct mental health services, so you can access information to contact me if interested. So my first stop would be the recommendation to visit the website, which is mmjerniganassociates.com. But certainly, if you're on social media, including Facebook, we do have a Facebook page, which is Jernigan and Associates Psychological and Educational Consulting.
We thank you so much for your service, Dr. Jernigan. I look forward to seeing what you're doing in the future.
Thank you.
That concludes today's Rich Answers program from the Conference of Churches on Light 100.5 WRCH. If you enjoyed hearing our segments today, you can download them for free on iTunes. Also, be sure to connect with us on the web at conferenceofchurches.org or contact us on Facebook or Twitter to suggest a guest or topic you would like to learn more about. I'm Reverend Dr. Shelley Best from the Conference of Churches. Thank you for listening. God bless you, and have a wonderful day.